Hello.
Today we're creeping around hospital corridors with the cast of the thriller The Secret She Keeps. We discuss the appeal of international actors in local series, look back at Arrested Development, play 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn, and check in with what our critics are watching when they're off duty. From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Here with me today are my fellow mummy bloggers from the Herald and the Age newsrooms, guide and Green Guide columnist and reviewer Debbie Enker, and calling in from our LA studio is our culture editor-at-large Michael Adardo. How are you both?
Hello, good.
Hi Louise, I'm fine.
We're starting this episode with Channel 10's six-part domestic noir, The Secret She Keeps, based on the international best-selling novel by Australian crime author Michael Rowbotham. It's about two women, the affluent pregnant mummy blogger Megan, played by Jessica DeGaulle, who befriends struggling supermarket worker Agatha, played by English actress Laura Carmichael, who is best known as Lady Edith Crawley in Downton Abbey. At the beginning, it appears both women are pregnant, and this isn't giving away too many spoilers because it's all there in the ads, but their lives soon become entwined and the secrets they are both keeping, affairs, trauma, questionable paternity and lies, begin to surface. It's a twisty suburban nightmare filled with baby bumps, bad husbands, bad friends, dodgy real estate agents, and the kind of lax hospital security that would give most new mothers nightmares. Before we start, let's listen to this clip, which features Agatha talking to her ex-partner Nikki, played by Richard Sydenham.
No, that's what he said, wasn't it, the specialist? He said it'd be like winning the lottery.
He also said sometimes these things happen when you stop IVF. Sometimes that's how it works.
Yes, it does. So who's the lucky father?
Donor.
You're doing it all alone.
You know how much I wanted this. And I've never felt less alone.
Michael, were you drawn into the secrets and lies of The Secret She Keeps?
Look, I have to say, I was. In terms of the story, I will probably just say up front that if you've not read the novel, and I had not read the novel, the twist, at least the initial twist in the story, comes at you like a number 94 bus. I feel like I kind of, within a couple of minutes, I was like, oh, okay, well, that's obviously what's going on. That is actually not necessarily a disadvantage, I don't think, because I think this is one of those shows that sort of rides you out on that sort of drawn out tension-wise. Because I think what kind of holds you in place is that sort of the unbearableness of the journey. It's a bit like the Titanic. You know, you walk into the movie, you know that, here's spoiler warning, the boat sinks. You know, Psycho is probably a really good example of something that's the same. You know he's coming. You know it's all going to happen in the shower scene, but somehow you're still kind of rigid, you know, in your seat because you're kind of, you know, you're sort of drawn in to the tension. I thought this was, there's a richness to this, which is really fascinating. That probably comes from Michael Rowbotham's writing. It feels like a really sort of complete world, and it also feels really, I thought, oddly cinematic. The frame's really wide, the camera's really wide, there's a lovely cinematic kind of quality to it. The world felt kind of unexpectedly rich for something where I've only been there for a couple of hours and I've only really met Megan and Jack, the couple, and Agatha, the soon-to-be single mother. I was absolutely drawn in.
Debbie, Channel 10 have been really good at commissioning female-focused drama with The Secret Life of Us, Offspring, Five Bedrooms, Sisters, Puberty Blues. Have they tapped into a winning formula here?
If you look at kind of Channel 9, you think, yep, they love a crime story. You look at Channel 7 and you think, I'm not sure what they're doing now. But you look at Channel 10 and you think you can very much see where their priorities are in terms of the sorts of dramas that they're interested in. And the thing that I really liked about the way this one started, which Michael was talking about, it's got a real mood of menace to it from the beginning. Things feel kind of slightly off. You know, there are dogs barking in the night. The Shaughnessys are not exactly sure why. This is pregnant Megan and her husband Jack. She's a mummy blogger. She's getting these hateful messages on her blog. She doesn't know where they're coming from. There are just things happening that make you feel that the ostensibly perfect world that they look like they're inhabiting, you know, they look like everything's going well. But from very early on, you get the sense that things are not right. Mm. And that was one of the things I really liked about it, along with the contrast in the lives between the two women.
Yeah.
Agatha looks miserable, and we know that Laura Carmichael can do very good miserable from, you know, years on Downton. She's excellent at miserable, and she's frustrated, she's envious, and the one decision I really like that they made that does carry through, and I have problems with other decisions, but is that Megan's a good person. Megan isn't an entitled rich bitch of a woman. She might take some of the things in her life for granted, but she's essentially kind of quite a generous person. And I really like that in the early setup between the two women.
But she's certainly not perfect either. We don't want to spoil the plot, but something happens, and it reminds me of the Twitter account called Men Writing Women, which calls out the way male authors describe women's actions and how they look and behave in fiction, which is quite interesting if you look it up, because I just didn't believe a rational woman would behave that way.
That's very much where I came to by the end of it. There are a number of decisions made along the way that made me less and less satisfied with it, and they were to do with the plotting and to do with the way the two characters developed.
I think it's interesting you kind of react in that way. I mean, I'm probably less sensitive to men writing women in that way. Like I don't perhaps see it in the same way. But this I did notice this had two female directors and two writers, a male writer and a female writer. Mm. Other than the fact that the kind of baseline comes from Michael Robotham, who's a man, I thought there was a strong female voice or female presence in the production. I was what I loved really about these two women was that they both present at first glance as kind of quite familiar characters, which is the sort of the hyper successful and the broken. And then actually as you kind of start to watch, the hyper successful Megan is actually a complete wreck. And, you know, and and Agatha, while Agatha's broken, her world is simpler. She has an innocent quality which sits a little oddly as you watch it, and it sort of starts to take on, it's got to delve into its kind of its creepier layers. I just thought it was fascinating that the women ultimately neither of them was quite who I thought she would be.
I think as it goes on, Agatha gets too damaged. The insults that have shaped her life, the abuse that shaped her life is piled on, I think. Lay it on with a trowel, you know, one thing after another. And the thing I like about the Megan character that explores this whole mummy blogger thing is the idea of women presenting to the world an impression of a perfect life that taps into this thing that women have about, you know, you should look good, you should be a perfect mother, you should have a gorgeous looking house, you need a really lovely partner, and that's the image you present to the world, and that's a false image. I'm interested in that. But I think with crime stories generally, they need to be about more than just the suspense and the next cliffhanger and the next reveal. They need to tell you about a community. They need to tell you about a society and the way it works. And for me, the more this went on, the less there was of that and the more there was of just the suspense. Will they be able to save whoever needs saving? If it becomes just about the suspense of what's going to happen next, it's less interesting for me.
At the end of Secret She Keeps, the credits don't appear. They just go straight to a website where it says if you want to see a full list of credits, so producers, directors, supporting cast, everything, go to a website. I mean, I find it really rude when a TV show does that. It doesn't give all the people, the production staff who've worked on a show their due credit, essentially, does it?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's awful. I mean, I'm of either a generation or an industry where I was taught, particularly with film screenings, that it was incredibly impolite, as people do, to get up and leave as the credits start. I'm one of those people. I've always had friends who worked in film or television, so I've always watched. I've got to watch it to the end because, you know, those people deserve their due. And it's also not even a question of the fact that those people work behind the scenes. Most of those people impact what you watch. I mean, we're talking about people like the directors of photography and production designers and art departments and everybody who assembles the pieces of that kind of that building, they kind of get to get swiped off onto a website list. It's a really gruesome way to do it.
It's a real insult to everyone who worked on it to do that, to not acknowledge their contribution.
I can't recall any time in the 500 years that I've been alive where I have actually sat through a really, really terrible show that I didn't want to watch simply because the show before it cleverly ended quickly and somehow hoodwinked me into it. I think Debbie's right. It just treats the audience as idiots. It's a dumb gimmick. It's disrespectful to the people who work on the show, and it's disrespectful to the people who watch it.
And I can't imagine many people watching it rushing off to their, you know, tablets or phones to check the credits.
Totally.
I agree. Maybe for this we should all make the effort to search for the credits and pay the cast and crew the respect they deserve. For everyone listening in, stick around because we have plenty more to discuss, including a look back at one of the greatest comedies in Arrested Development. We play 6 Degrees of Ben Mendelsohn, and we'll find out what Michael and Debbie are binging. But now, let's move on to the big question. Can and should an international actor star in an Australian series? As we mentioned, in The Secret She Keeps, Downton Abbey actress Laura Carmichael has been brought in to play the lead role of Agatha. She keeps her English accent in the show, with a few cracks in an Australian one in a few episodes. But why did we need her? After all, the story was already transplanted from London to Sydney, and the rest of the cast was switched from English to Australian. So why not stick with a local cast? Other examples include, say, Dominic West in Stateless, Yoan Gruffudd in Harrow, Miriam Margolyes in Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. But is it as simple as getting an international star to boost your audience, or should we be employing our own talent purely to provide local jobs? Debbie, is it just a case of cultural cringe that we feel we need foreign actors to boost interest in local stories?
I suspect it's a case of the commercial aspect of the production becoming important, that in order to put together the money that producers need to finance making a production or to make it more attractive for sales overseas, it's good to have an internationally recognised name. But really how effective it is kind of depends on the nature of the production and the role and the particular actor who's cast. Dominic West was fine in Stateless. I think Laura Carmichael does a good job in Secrets She Keeps, largely because she's playing a character who's come from England, so the accent works. The ones I really have trouble with are the ones where international actors come and try to play Australians and the accents are terrible. And you think, why didn't they use a local actor for that? And I understand the commercial aspect of it, but often it just doesn't work.
I mean, there are government guidelines that cover entry into Australia of foreign actors for the purpose of employment in film and TV productions. The arts minister or a person authorised by the minister must be satisfied that the casting of leading and major supporting roles accurately reflects the Australian characters portrayed, that at least 50% of performers in leading roles and 75% of performers in major supporting roles are Australian, and where applicable, an Australian actor has been cast to play a traditional Australian character, whatever that means. Michael, we've given the world Cate Blanchett, Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe. Isn't it sort of appropriate we get some big name talent back in like a TV student exchange type arrangement?
We don't seem to think it's a problem when we send our best and fairest into the UK and the US markets and they take jobs from British actors and American actors. And we've always been very resistant to the idea that other countries would do the same thing to us. But there are some kind of natural economies of scale kind of in play there. Those markets are massive. The American market, the British market, they can take the heat. You know, the Australian market is small and fragile, and there is a need to protect our ability for the market to tell Australian stories and also to tell Australian stories by putting Australian voices and performances into the key parts. That said, 20 years ago, Australian drama cost $250,000 and an Australian network might have put up 150 of it. That nowadays it costs a million, and in some cases Australian networks probably still only want to put up 250 of it. So there's this increasing chunk of it has to be funded other ways. The most obvious way, obviously, is overseas sale. And I think that requires us to deliver programs that can be sold internationally. And I think this Secret She Keeps is a really good example because you kind of see it in two ways, which is not just Laura Carmichael, who's a British actress and therefore somehow secures you a sale because it can be sold overseas as a show that stars an actress from Downton Abbey, but even an actor like Michael Dorman, who's an Australian actor, but he's worked in the US and he's in, you know, a show for Apple. He's an actor who kind of has an international credential. So even with the Australian cast, obviously there's a hunger for Australian actors who can carry a little bit of that commercial power as well. And what's revealing there is, in a sense, it does mean that we are valuing actors who have greater international commercial value as opposed to an Australian actor who has not got an international or an American or British credential.
I think a really good, interesting current example is something like Mystery Road, where you've got the production tailored in a way that it is a very Australian story, that it's using a really classic Australian landscape. You've got Erin Pedersen in the lead, but you cast Sophia Helen from The Bridge, who has an international reputation, but she's playing a character from her part of the world. Like she's not attempting to portray, you know, an Australian archaeologist who's stuck up in Broome looking at bones. So there is a way that you can construct particular stories to make the presence of an international actor who is going to help you sell it work for you in that way without actually diminishing the integrity of the story.
That's true. And we're going to move on to game time. This week we're playing Michael's favourite game, 6 Degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. So this is based on the 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon game, where every actor in Hollywood can be linked to Kevin Bacon in 6 steps or less through their acting credits, except we're going the full Mendo and linking to Australia's favourite, Ben Mendelsohn. This week we're starting with Evan Rachel Wood, who plays Dolores in Westworld. It's a HBO dystopian sci-fi western that's incredibly confusing, has a high boob count. It's created by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, and it's based on a 1973 film of the same name, written and directed by Michael Crichton. So, can you link Evan Rachel Wood to Ben Mendelsohn?
Evan Rachel Wood is amazing. I primarily know her as Queen Iduna in Frozen 2. So I'm going to, I mean, but the thing is I'm at a loss to get from Frozen 2 to Ben Mendelsohn.
The hint is Australian. There is an Australian actor in Westworld that
is the
starts
connection.
The chain to Ben Mendelsohn.
Well, that's going to be a Hemsworth. There's a Hemsworth in Westworld.
You've got the first step. I will give you that, Michael.
Okay,
you've got the first step.
There we go.
So now you've got to think. The third best Hemsworth is somehow linked to Evan Rachel Wood. If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to check out another new podcast from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's called Good Weekend Talks, and each week you can listen to a full read-through of its most popular cover stories, from inside Scott Morrison's Pentecostal church to the Spanish flu. Were we ready for another pandemic? You can listen to the definitive stories that matter to Australians. So after this episode, go and search Good Weekend Talks. For our back catalogue show today, we're looking at a US comedy that features an Australian actress, Portia de Rossi, in a lead role. It is, of course, Arrested Development. It's the story of the gloriously dysfunctional Bluth family. Their real estate business has gone bust. There's no money in the banana stand. While Michael Bluth, the show's moral compass and the elder son, played by Jason Bateman, doing his signature straight man move, is trying to hold them all together. It originally ran for 3 seasons from 2003 and has been hailed as one of the best TV comedies of all time. But its legacy gets a little complicated after that. After it was cancelled by the Fox network, it was revived by Netflix in 2013 for a critically panned 4th season, which was then re-edited and re-released, while its 5th season in 2019 was mired in the Me Too controversy after an interview featuring the cast included Jessica Walter, who plays the wonderful matriarch Lucille Bluth, crying about how she was yelled at on set by Jeffrey Tambor, while the rest of the cast then proceeded to talk over her. There's been no word on a 6th season and Netflix appears to have quietly dropped it. Before we jump in, let's take a listen to this clip, which features Michael Bluth talking to his mother Lucille, with an appearance by Portia de Rossi as Lindsay and narration by Ron Howard, who also produced and starred in the series.
This is Michael's mother.
Look what they've done, Michael.
She isn't happy.
Look what the homosexuals have done to me.
You can't just calm that out and reset it?
Currently, she's upset that her husband's retirement party is being upstaged by a group of gay protesters.
We want to get back to Nelson!
Everything I do is so dramatic and flamboyant, it just makes me want to set myself on fire. Good grief, not all homosexuals are flamboyant. Oh my God, I have the exact same blouse.
This is Michael's twin sister, Lindsay.
I like it better on him.
We're going to talk about classic Arrested Development. We'll dip into the new stuff, but does classic Arrested Development still stand as a great comedy, or has its legacy been ruined a little bit, do you think?
No, I think it does still stand. I mean, we've sort of talked about the whole idea of kind of tainted art in the past and what that means. It doesn't disrespect the consumer, but it does sort of presume that I'm not mature enough to understand the difference and that somehow I can't watch something and sort of separate all of its pieces. And the truth is I can watch Arrested Development and I can know that Jeffrey Tambor is potentially not a great person based on all of these things that have happened, And it doesn't mean I can't laugh at, you know, anyone in the show. I mean, this is the show where kind of Jason Bateman's career came back. Will Arnett was discovered. Tony Hale kind of broke through. Michael Cera broke through. You know, it's a masterpiece. It's really, really funny. It's sort of, you know, it's dark and twisted and sort of beautifully sharp in a really unexpected and in inventive way. It's got things that linger. It's got, you know, Steve Holt. It's kind of got stuff that it's got stuff that oddly hasn't left us. And it even gave us the kind of that sort of conversational narrator meme where I would say to you, I'm really good at playing 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn, but my narrator, Ron Howard, would say a moment later, he was not actually good at playing 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. And I actually think that narrator kind of meme, whatever you'd call it, is magical. It's really, look, this is a wonderful show. It's incredibly funny to watch. It's just it's one of those shows where I think every scene is loaded. And when you watch it for the fifth time, you see things you didn't see on the preceding four. And I love it for that. I do love it for that.
Yeah, it is so worth a rewatch. Debbie, are you a fan?
It has not been hailed by me as one of the great comedies of all time.
Tell us, what's your problem?
Look, I think for me the problem is from the time you meet them, we know they're awful. I mean, yeah. Jason Bateman's character is kind of the struggling nice guy with his poor son, played by Michael Cera, who are, you know, the two decent people in this really vile family where they're greedy and they're conniving and they're self-serving and vicious. And because it's a situation comedy, none of that changes about any of them. What you see at the beginning is what they remain all the way through. The only thing that changes is the different situations they're put in and how they react to it. And I was not sufficiently engaged by any of them to start with to want to really persevere with every episode and see what sort of awful trouble they got themselves in and the mean things that they did to get themselves out of it. I appreciate some of it and it made me laugh a bit, sort of fitfully, but I think I generally find comedies that have a bit of warmth to them attract me more. That's, you know, a personal problem for me. It means I don't get excited about things like Curb Your Enthusiasm or Seinfeld because I prefer the warmer sitcoms. So with Arrested Development for me is one of those ones where the characters are a bit like chess pieces moving around. It's kind of quite enjoyable, but it doesn't mean I want to be there with them for every episode.
But I mean, there was growth. George Michael kind of
got taller. Yeah,
got taller, he had a crush on maybe. He got a little bit incestuous, and then they kind of moved on. That's growth, isn't it? Do you realise you can't maybe be in love with your cousin?
Yes, but the thing is, there wasn't enough tickling me from the beginning to make me want to sit in there for 84 episodes and see what would happen to them. I feel like I get it from the start. It can be really clever. Mm. I mean, and I like watching. You know, I think Portia de Rossi is wonderful to watch. I think Jessica Walter's wonderful to watch. Tony Hale. There are some terrific performances and there's some very clever writing. But fundamentally I see it as clever, but it doesn't engage me in the way that other comedies do.
Debbie, you big softy.
It is an interesting thing. I mean, I would say, I mean, as much as I love it, I absolutely love it, and I would absolutely draw the line between those first three seasons and what came later. And I love those first three seasons. But I do think you're right in the sense that it is one of those, it's a little bit like the atypical potato chip flavour, which is kind of when you kind of go, oh, chicken chips or barbecue chips, people are kind of okay. But when someone goes, oh, I've got sour cream and onion, half the room goes, oh, my God, they're my favourite chip. And the other half room goes, oh, my God. I mean, who brought those? Half the house thinks it's the best potato chip and the other half just gets sick eating it. And actually that is probably very true of this. It's a very specific kind of comedy. For me, it's very character based. So it's and performer based. It's also about that world of supporting characters. It's almost as much about, you know, Liza Minnelli playing Lucille too, Lucille Ostero, as it is about, you know, or Henry Winkler, who was the lawyer, or that guy, whoever he was, who was George Sr.'s friend who used to scare the children by staging horror accidents to, you know, the one where he like runs at the window of the car and his arm's off and there's blood squirting and he winds down, all the children scream and he winds down the window and says, and that, kids, is why you never put your hand out of the window in traffic. I mean, these harrowingly gorgeous moments. But I think it's so much about that. It has such specificity in its comedy. you kind of either love it or you just don't. It's just not there for you.
I do love the potato chip analogy.
Don't you think? I think we can workshop that. I think that's got legs. That does.
That's perfect. But when they start wheeling in a lot of guest stars, I think you've run out of ideas with the core cast, and you need to jazz things up.
They aren't guest stars in the traditional sense. That's why I said before, they're sort of almost like The Simpsons. The Simpsons has the Simpson family and this recurring supporting cast of about 200 characters from Mr. Burns and Smithers and Carl and, you know, Lenny and comic book guy and Apu. There's this wonderful universe of people that kind of all swirl through in different ways in different episodes. And that's, I do think that this Arrested's a show that's very informed by that comic book form, the idea that there is this peculiar sort of extensive expanded universe of people who all return. I mean, you know, they don't just do one walkthrough. They all kind of come back through it, and it kind of makes the universe more complete.
Look, I agree. Henry, I was going to say, in terms of the supporting cast, Henry Winkler is pretty much my favourite in that. As he plays the lawyer, but I love that. I reckon that kind of kicked off his sort of really skewed personality, because he went off then to do Parks and Rec, play the, you know, the scheming obstetrician in Parks and Recreation.
Barry,
and then Barry, which is brilliant in.
I think Barry is, I mean, certainly for an actor like Henry Winkler, was an absolute, you know, an absolutely extraordinary kind of piece of work. It's a HBO comedy about a trained assassin from a family of assassins who decides to break with the family business and become an actor. He then comes under the tutorage of Henry Winkler, who is a particularly ordinary acting teacher in the show. But it's a beautiful performance, and it's a really good example of how I think Arrested Development seemed to just bounce people out of its cast list. I will say this, the most wonderful thing about the Barry role particularly is I interviewed Henry Winkler for it, and he the thing that really stunned me, and he brought it up in a couple of interviews, and I feel like everyone was stunned by it, was everyone seemed to approach him with the idea that somehow he was Henry Winkler, this legend who'd been offered this role in this show by HBO. And he, in fact, revealed that he is Henry Winkler, the jobbing actor, and he went to an audition for that role, and he sat in a waiting room with 23 other Henry Winkler types.
For Barry.
And they all went, and they all went in one by one and they read for it. He read like every other actor. And he's terribly proud of that. He actually is really proud that he's a jobbing actor who still auditions and has to go in and fight for the part, which I kind of think is almost criminal because, I mean, he's Henry Winkler and he's a legend. But it's also refreshingly real. It's a really lovely, authentic kind of way to do the job.
Oh, very good. Okay, let's leave Arrested Development there for Debbie's sake and jump through to what you're both watching. Debbie, what's on your list this week?
I've been watching Normal People on Stan, which is, I have not read Sally Rooney's book, but it's a half-hour episodes, 12-part series about a relationship between two Irish teenagers who meet and start an affair in high school, and it's following them through to college in Dublin. They live in the Sligo area, very pretty. She comes from a troubled family, but the family has money. Her name is Marianne. She's played by Daisy Edgar-Jones. The casting in the series is superb. Paul Mescal plays Connell. His mother cleans house for Marianne's family. That's kind of one of the ways they meet, though they're also in the same class. And I've just found it absolutely captivating. It's beautifully shot. I'm really engaged with the characters and really concerned about how their relationship is going and to find out what will happen to them. I'm going to be sorry when it finishes after 12 episodes.
Yeah, I just finished reading the book in anticipation of the TV series, and it's a short book, but I had it done in like 3 days after a couple of late nights. Couldn't put it down. Anyway, Michael, what are you watching?
I'd watched initially the first few episodes and then left it, and I've just gone back and watched the last batch of episodes of Avenue 5, which is the HBO sci-fi comedy by Armando Iannucci. Oh. It's one of those shows. Sci-fi comedy is really hard. I always say to people, it's like the impossible genre. Nobody's done it properly since Red Dwarf. And the only show that I think has come close to getting it right since Red Dwarf is The Orville, And Avenue 5 doesn't always get it right. It was really – I watched the first couple of episodes because I had to do interviews with the actors, and then I sort of let it go and I watched like a few more and thought, oh, this isn't that great. And I thought to myself while I've been kind of catching up on things, I was like, I've got to watch this last block of episodes. When I got back into it, I was like, oh, I kind of miss these people. I actually really enjoy this world. It's really lovely. You know, Josh Gad is really funny. Rebecca Front is kind of the actual star of the show. She's kind of the really pushy passenger. It's essentially a show about a cruise liner in the future that goes through space, and there's like a massive malfunction and they end up off course, and there's this sort of 8-year journey they're facing to come back to Earth kind of the slow way. What they discover when they're actually out there and everything's gone wrong is that apart from a couple of sort of techie geeks working in the basement of the ship to keep it all running, everyone who is the crew, so all the officers on the bridge, the captain, they're all actually paid actors, and none of the controls do anything, and the ship is pre-programmed, and they're all paid just to perform this kind of glamorous, high-tech, super spaceship stuff. And actually, when the crunch comes, they're just no good to anybody, and everyone's kind of trying to solve their situation. It has weak moments, but I'm very much enjoying it.
I'm finally getting to the final series of Homeland. It's just finished on SBS, but I'm watching it on SBS On Demand. It is the story of CIA agent Carrie Mathison, played by Claire Danes, who's one of the best cries on TV. I just love how her face totally crumples. And her boss Saul, played by the gloriously bearded Mandy Patinkin. It's one of the few shows I've religiously watched from the beginning. It's gone a bit loopy in parts for me because I never really bought the affair between Carrie and Brody. But I love that it's so unsentimental about its characters, and that most episodes you won't know who will live or die. And I love the dysfunctional relationship between Carrie and Saul, and I can't wait to see how season 8 ends. That's me. Right. Game time again. So we've gone from Evan Rachel Wood to Luke Hemsworth. How are we getting to Ben Mendelsohn?
Can we do a thematic link that is not appropriate and probably has no bearing on this whatsoever about child stars, about actors who start early? And then, you know, I remember watching Evan Rachel Wood and thinking she was fabulous playing the teenage daughter in Once and Again, and I cherish the memory of that show and of her performance in it. And Ben Mendelsohn, you know, started young, and both of them have managed to make really interesting adult careers. That is my contribution to these steps, which I know is of no value whatsoever.
Nice. We have a winner. Michael's got his arms up.
No, we have a winner. We have a winner. No, I'm just declaring the win for Debbie. I've got no idea. Because essentially I'll tell you where I'm at. I'm at Evan Rachel Wood works with Luke Hemsworth, and Luke Hemsworth must have been in something with Ben Mendelsohn, but I have absolutely no idea what the something is.
Okay. So Luke Hemsworth starred with Susie Porter in Bikey Wars, Brothers in Arms.
Oh, God, I hated that.
Good Lord.
I mean, who doesn't want to watch the dramatisation of the Milpera Massacre? I mean,
it was 6 episodes or something.
So then, of course, Susie was, and we are kind of doing a bit of a jump to film here, but Susie starred with Ben in Mullet. David Caesar's great, great comedy. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for your patience today with 6 Degrees of Ben Mendelsohn and your excellent insights, as always, into our shows. I hope you have a happy week watching.
You too.
Thank you.
Good to talk.
All right, guys, if you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app, and please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Adado, and Debbie is at Debbie Enker, and you can find myself at Lou_Roog. You can also read stories by Michael, Debbie or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugenreich. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan, and our head of audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.